Welcome to American Dream. I'm your host, Tina Richards. The U.S. economy, there are so many fears out there from people about whether the sinking dollar, all these houses going into foreclosure, where are we at with our economy? Where are we going this next year? To discuss this tonight, we have with us Dr. or Professor Kent Hughes, Director of Program on Science, Technology, U.S. and Global Economy. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Dr. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, senior fellow, Peterson Institute for International Economics, and also an advisor for John McCain's presidential policy advisor. Welcome to the show. Well, we're thinking about what's happening with the economy, one of the first things that comes to my mind is every day I see the U.S. dollar valuation sinking. Where is this coming from, Kent?
Well, there are a couple things that are involved. In part, it simply reflects that the U.S. has been living beyond its means for quite a while. We've been running a current account and trade deficit that's approached 6% of everything that we make here in the country. And had we been any other country, why, we would have seen that kind of adjustment sooner. There's some good aspects. If you notice that U.S. exports are up, trying to bring the whole international financial system back into balance, and those increase in exports has to some extent offset the decline in housing construction.
Isn't the increase in the exports is mainly due to the dollar value sinking so rapidly, though?
Well, it certainly makes U.S. exports more competitive and more attractive, but as you have those exports go up, it means more activity related to the exports and eventually more jobs related to them as well. So that really is good and necessary news for the U.S., but also really for the global economy that needs to move back into better balance.
Dean, would you like to comment on
that? Well, I'd largely agree with that. I'd take it a little different direction, though. I mean, I think it was a mistake that we had the dollar be so high. I would have taken steps to try and bring down the dollar. Well, there are a number, you could, in principle, try to negotiate a lower dollar with our trading partners, including China, first and foremost, but also with Europeans. But if need be, you take steps, the Federal Reserve Board and the Treasury can actually intervene in international currency markets and actually sell dollars to push down the value of the dollar.
Alan Greenspan was not, had any interest.
No, he had absolutely no interest in doing that. And I think that was a mistake, because I think, you know, we will pay a price. We've been fortunate thus far that we haven't seen any inflationary impact from the falling dollar. My expectation is that we will start to see that. We've already seen prices of goods from China are now rising at about a 4-4.5% annual rate. My guess is that that will increase. We will also, again, this is my expectation, start to see higher prices of imports of European goods. So far, it's been, at least to my mind, remarkable that there's been very little increase in price of goods from Europe and most of our other trading partners. But sooner or later, I'm confident that they will pass on some of the impact of the change in currency prices. So I think we will see higher inflation from that. That's a necessary price. We will have to pay that. But I think we've been better had we taken the steps years ago so that we weren't in the situation today. And in fact, we put off the pain.
And when you talk about the inflation, a lot of people hear inflation versus core inflation. And they don't understand. They're looking at the gas pumps. They're looking at the cost of milk. And they see these just skyrocketing. But yet inflation is saying that it's really not a risk because of the measurement. Could you explain a little bit about the measurement of core inflation?
Yeah, what the Fed, and I think is right in doing this, what the Fed is focused on is inflation that excludes food and energy prices. And the reasoning there is that these are very volatile. They jump up and down all the time. So what they've tried to do is pull those sectors of the economy out of their measure of inflation, look at other goods and services with the idea that when you include food and energy, you end up with just an erratic measure. We want to focus on the other sectors of the economy. So that doesn't mean that when, you know, people go to pay for their gas, we know it costs them more money. That's out of their wages. That's a hit to them. But in terms of, you know, what the Fed could hope to do something about, they're not going to bring down the price of oil by tightening up on the economy, or at least very, very indirectly, I should say. So the inflation that the Fed worries about, I think they're appropriately looking at the core measure. They're right to do that. So that doesn't mean people get the impression no one cares about, you know, that you pay higher prices. Absolutely, they care that you pay higher prices at the gas or at the grocery store.
But when it's over such a long sustained period, I mean, we were looking at a barrel of oil at close to $99 a couple of weeks ago. It's down to $88. Everybody's celebrating. A couple of years ago were unheard of. So this is over a long sustained period now that people have been paying high energy costs. Now the heating oil, that's definitely has been in Baltimore. It was doubled. They recently had a
right.
I mean, these are long sustained.
No, those are real costs.
But
the question is, and again, the Fed isn't trying to decide, you know, how best. You know, obviously, this is affecting people's living standard. And if we're going to say, you know, what's been going on with people's wages, people's income, we would look at a measure of inflation that includes, you know, the energy prices, that includes food, because that's part of people's consumption basket. But in terms of the Fed's targeting for monetary policy, they've rightly made the choice to simply focus on the core inflation because, again, the idea is these are volatile components and they really can't do anything about it, or at least very, very indirectly.
A really erratic dollar as opposed to
sinking
as it is. And the U.S. dollar.
I think the important thing to remember is that the dollar is a reflection of other things. It's a price. And like all prices, it goes up and down in response to fundamentals. I think for that reason, it's important to keep your eye on the fundamentals. Kent was right. Part of our fundamentals was we don't save enough as a nation. Lots of investment opportunities here. So we financed it by borrowing abroad. And as a result, built up these large external deficits. We did a pretty good job of keeping an eye on inflation. And I guess I'd part company with Dean in having the Fed aggressively manage the dollar on that front. I think the Fed ought to be focused on keeping inflation low and stable. That's been the recipe for success for 20 years in the United States, 25 years. So we need to take care of fundamentals. The dollar will do what it's going to do. I don't think it's a surprise it's going down, and I don't think it's a catastrophe either.
Well, we went out to the street and asked some people their opinions of where this economy is headed. I'd like to listen to the people on the street.
I think the sinking dollar is just a function of the global economy, and America's got a little learning to do, and now that we're experiencing that kind of competition, everyone's not going to assume that America's economy is always going to be great so that the dollar should be worth that much. I mean, would some people say we shouldn't have gone off a gold standard? I don't know, but I think that's just the nature of it, and we're going to have to rethink what everybody's opinion is regarding how strong our economy is.
What I see as the U.S. economy are symptomatic of a profound social change, with class division so extreme, and people who could anticipate living a comfortable life and educating their children may no longer be able to do so, and that the flow of wealth is being so limited that the U.S. will become, in many senses, a third world economy for some people and a plutocracy for others.
My brother is happy about the dollar. He lives in Germany. I'm not happy about the dollar because I do a lot of traveling outside the U.S. with U.S. dollars.
Well, I don't think the U.S. economy is where it was 4 or 5 years ago, but it still looks pretty good. Unemployment's at a good rate. I mean, if you look compared to the U.S. economy to where it is other places in the world, it's not that bad. However, the dollar is falling, and hopefully that will spur interest or money from other countries and help, you know, get our trade deficit in order.
The mortgage crisis, the dollar, you know, it's not going to affect the enrichment of those who are already getting richer and richer, and will affect those who believe they had a share in the American dream very adversely.
And I'd like to, that last lady, when she said that, you know, the people that need to buy into the American dream, that want to buy into the American dream, and kind of taking from what she said, that hasn't done that yet, that they're just beginning to do that. What is this economy going to be able to offer them?
Well, I think one of the interesting points she made was, you know, let's look at the mortgage crisis and who is this going to hit? Well, I think that's central to thinking about how the economy is going to evolve. The mortgage crisis came out of a situation in which there were a lot of individuals who bought a house strictly for investment purposes. They expected the price always to go up.
There's also a lot of people buying first-time homeowners.
Let me finish. So we've got folks buying these houses for investment purposes. We've got banks and hedge funds giving them money without checking to see if they're really creditworthy and counting on the house prices going up. And then what happens? Well, you know, prices don't always go up. They start coming down to earth. And those investors are unable to make their mortgages, and those banks are going to lose some money, and the hedge funds are going to be out. I think they should be out of the money. Now, it's important that they didn't do due diligence and that we not step in and rescue them. Your point, which is the right one, is there are people who have the financial wherewithal to be in a home, that's been a foundation of American society, but they're in the wrong mortgage, and they're in the wrong mortgage because they're misled, or in some cases worse, and that's the group we have to find, target, and help. And if we do that, we can reestablish the sense that there is a covenant in the United States where people will have an opportunity to move forward. I think it's a very important moment for policymaking.
And when we talk about the American dream and it's starting out, recently the other day I saw on the news a headline saying that productivity is up, wages are low, good news for financial markets. I looked at that and thought, well, what about the workers? Their wages are going down. They're working harder. The wages are going down. What about them? Where does this leave them in the American dream?
It's like all prices. If you're on the side buying something and the price is low, that sounds great. But if you're the one selling it, that's bad. And we've seen over the past, five, six, 7 years, productivity growth is very good. But we've seen two phenomena that I think have troubled people. Number one, for a long time, we just didn't see the compensation of workers matching that productivity. And then when it finally did, too much of it was getting eaten up by health care costs. So I think it's imperative that we come to terms with the health care issue, because it's robbing many people of their productivity gains, because it's all going into paying for health care.
I wanted to take a little issue with the way Doug was characterizing the mortgage situation. I agree completely, by the way. I do want to see the hedge funds and speculators get nailed. There's absolutely no public interest in bailing out the people who are holding, these mortgages. They should have known what they were doing. But tying this back to the dollar, I mean, when I look at what's going on over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I see that you had a speculative bubble in house prices. So if you look at house prices adjusted for inflation since the mid-90s, they've risen by about 70%. Now, if you look back over the entire, Robert Shiller at Yale went back 100 years, 1895 to 1995, house prices over that 100-year period had just kept even with the rate of inflation. So here you have this departure from, as far back as you can go. I don't know what happens if you go back before 1895, but, it's 100 years of history. And it's very hard for me to explain that as anything other than a speculative bubble. Now, what kept that going? Well, we had very low interest rates through much of this period. Part of the reason we had very low interest rates was we had a lot of money flowing in from abroad. This was what was keeping the dollar high. This is, again, why I think it would have been good policy for the Fed to try and attack the dollar, try and attack this speculative bubble, which is now bursting, and it's creating, people talk about a subprime crisis. That really is just the tip of the iceberg, because if you look at default rates on prime mortgages, those are now as high in the latest data as what they were on subprime mortgages 2 or 3 years ago. So when we talk about the subprime crisis, well, the subprime borrowers, as we know, are the most vulnerable people. They don't have $20,000 in a bank account or a 401k or parents and siblings they could borrow money from when they fall behind. So they're the most vulnerable people. But the problem is house prices are falling, and they're likely to continue to fall. And you're going to see a lot of people that see essentially their life savings disappear, because for most people, most of their wealth is in their home. And when they see their home fall, in some cases 20 or 30%, which it will, they're going to find that they're approaching retirement with almost nothing there. So again, Doug was concerned about us not saving enough. He's absolutely right. But one of the main reasons we weren't saving enough is because people thought their homes were going up in price. Well, they were going up in price, but they thought they would continue to. That's in reverse now. So I think we have a very, very serious problem, and I consider it was major mismanagement on the part of the Fed not to try and tackle this bubble earlier.
I think all of the people you talked to on the street had legitimate concerns and insights, in fact. One fellow was talking about how the lower dollar was going to stimulate activity here and helping the trade deficit back into a more reasonable range. Ideally, we'd move towards something like balance. That's right. That is happening. Then the fellow who traveled overseas, that's where his business was, he suddenly was paying a lot more for an evening in London or a meal in Germany. And that's also true. And the lady was right, and I think Doug accurately sort of parsed the different kinds of people that are caught up in the subprime here, that you do have people who were buying just on speculation. They wanted to be in. They wanted that price to go up. They were going to flip that house. Sometimes there are anecdotes, anyway, that suggest individual houses or condominiums were flipped a couple times before they were actually finally occupied by someone. At the same time, the older lady really worried about something we haven't touched on, which has been a skewing of the income distribution in the United States over the last 20 years.
The rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. This is something that is definitely resonating out there.
The Wall Street Journal once featured its two rules of economics, the one that's so familiar that there's no free lunch, talking about if you do one thing, you can't do another. There's always an opportunity cost. But their iron law of income distribution was them what has gets. And in many ways, the U.S. has been a refutation of that, that we've had a strong middle class that grew rapidly after World War II. There was a much greater sharing of the prosperity. And the last 15 or 20 years, you've seen much more of a concentration toward the top of the income distribution. And it parallels what Doug identified as an area of rapid productivity growth that was not really paralleled by income growth. And I think it's something we do have to think about.
Clarify that just a little bit more.
Well, Doug was right to note that for a period we had very rapid productivity growth, but
right.
It wasn't translating to higher wages. And I'm saying in addition to that problem, you had a concentration of that added prosperity at the upper 20%, or even in many cases at the upper 1% of the income distribution. And that's something that we really need to concern ourselves with here in the States.
How would you, Dean, how would you try to approach to fix this?
Well,
it's
a very big concern, and you know, it has been very striking because, you know, basically it's our crudely described the post-war period. As both Doug and Kent have said, we had this period from the end of World War II into the 70s where you had very good productivity growth, where it was evenly shared, so everyone was benefiting from it. Then productivity growth weakens, you know, in the mid-70s up until the mid-90s, and then it begins to strengthen again. But the problem in that latter period is that almost all the gains from more rapid productivity growth went to high-end workers or owners of capital. So what you had was a situation where from the early 70s until the present, productivity, and I'm adjusting for some measurement issues, increased by about 50%, whereas compensation for a typical worker only increased about 20%, and about half of that simply went to health care costs. So they didn't see that in their paycheck. So the paycheck of a typical worker, what they actually took home, was only about 8% higher as of this year or last year than what it was in 73 once you adjust for inflation. So that's a very serious problem. Now, how do you address that? I think trade's part of the story. I think immigration has been to some extent part of the story. I think
how is immigration part of the story?
Well, immigration to some extent, you have immigration has disproportionately been less educated workers. So it's difficult for a doctor from the developing world to come and practice as a doctor in the United States. So our doctors don't in general compete with doctors from the developing world. On the other hand, if you're a less educated worker, particularly with someone without a high school degree, well, you have plenty of people from the developing world who are about to come up here and work as dishwashers, as construction workers, as many other less skilled jobs. So those people are directly competing with workers from the developing world who are willing to work for much lower wages. So it does have a downward pressure on their wages. So that's, again, it's part of the story. I don't want to exaggerate that because a lot of people have, and I think, you know, in some cases it's kind of racist the way they exaggerate, but it does have a negative impact. Part of it, I think, is, you know, simply the norms that have checked high-end wages have broken down. We see the stories, you know, and this ties in again with the, you know, the mortgage collapse, that you have major financial institutions, Merrill Lynch, Citibank, major financial institutions that are now forced to take multi-billion dollar write-offs. They basically fire their executives, and most of us think, well, you get fired, you know, they say, get out of here. Well, instead, they hand them $10 billion, the guy Merrill Lynch got somewhere around $40 million
dollars
to go away. I mean, that's a real problem in my book.
You want that job.
I want that job. Yeah. I could lose $10 million.
Well, when we,
I think if you step back and look at the historical perspective, and this has really been quite striking. I mean, Dean looked at some of these numbers on productivity, and I would have characterized it even more starkly. I mean, the post-war period up to the 70s was like nirvana. Everything went right. Somewhere around the early 70s, you pick the date, everything seemed to go wrong, and you have to figure out, you know, what caused that. My own view is it was divisional baseball, but
people point out the weakening of the labor movement.
Well, but there are profound changes there. We go off the gold standard. We move off a fixed exchange rate system. We inflation gets completely out of control. You know, the 70s are a very bad period. The oil shocks, bad mismanagement globally. Somewhere between there and the 90s, we basically don't get much productivity growth at all. It's really quite striking. It just goes away. But during that period, starting in the 80s into the 90s, we saw the wage distribution just widen. People at the top started making more. People at the bottom started making less. The thing just spread out. Starting in the mid-90s, the trend changed. The bottom stopped dropping, and the top keeps going up. And that's labor market earnings. And what most people recognize is that that part of income is driven by skills and education, And that means our problem is we have to generate more skills in education. And I think the imperative is to make the schools work in America. One of the great problems we have is about half of all inner city schools just don't work. And this is a major social issue. It's a huge difference across socioeconomic and racial groups. That's an imperative. That takes a long time, however. The second thing that's happened is we've seen this globalization of capital markets and now big returns to being able to move money around. Well, it makes sense in that kind of world, in my view, to stop clinging to the sort of New Deal view that all your pension benefits and health benefits come through the firm. Let's give them to the people. Let's let people have some capital so that everybody can get some of this high return to capital rather than just stand on the sidelines and watch other people get it. So we have to change the mix of what we do because it is a different world. It's a globalized world, a lot of challenges out there.
One of the Man on the Street interviews indicated that this is becoming a third world economy on that, where because we've gone to globalization, that it has almost become that America is becoming one of the third world economies.
It's a fear. It's not a fact. Mobility in the United States has not changed dramatically. I mean, you just can't make a solid research case that somehow the world is changed upside down. However, we do know some things, and they are the ones associated with skills in the labor market, and we should take care of those so that the fears don't turn into a reality.
We're getting ready to go to break. So
yeah, I'm more skeptical of Doug than on the skills argument because I just don't think it fits very well, and particularly if you look at the last 6 or 7 years, you see that the gap between college and non-college educated workers has not increased at all. So what you find in this period of rapid productivity growth, it's really just been very high-end workers, the top 2, 3, 4%, people with advanced degrees. And I'm a fan of education. I have an advanced degree myself. I don't have kids. If I did, I'd encourage them to get as much education as they can. But the fact is, I don't think that explains the growth in inequality we've seen over the last 25 years. I'd attribute it to things like, trade, immigration, the decline of unions, unionization rates have just plummeted in the last quarter century. So those are the factors I think are more important in explaining the growth in inequality.
Real quick.
Well, I'm probably in between Doug and Dean here, which is where the Wilson Center is, I suppose, usually. That I think that I agree with Dean that there's a lot of different causes here. And I do think that the distinction that some economists are beginning to make between whether you have a tradable service or a tradable skill or not makes a lot of difference. And that increasingly a group of highly educated people who didn't really face international competition now do because of the digital revolution and the coming on stream really of so many highly educated people in India, China, Brazil, really and around the world. I think that is an important element.
We're going to go ahead and go to break.
All right.
And we will return in just a moment. We will be right back.
Great. Thank you, Tina.
Welcome back to American Dream. Tonight's subject is about the U.S. economy, the sinking dollar, and where the housing market is going and what we have to look forward to as Americans with our economy. To discuss this, I'd like to welcome back Professor Kent Hughes, Director, Program on Science, Technology, U.S. and Global Economy. Dean Baker, Co-Director, Center for Economic and Policy Research. And Dr. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, Senior Fellow, Peterson Institute for International Economics. And just before we left off, you were finishing up. Kent?
Well, I just wanted to agree with two elements that Doug mentioned and put them together. First, we really need a safety net that's portable, that's not tied to your employment. That's health care and that's pensions. Second, we need a philosophy of broad-based training as you transition from one job to the next, ideally with a philosophy of upskilling, of improving your skills. I think that would make our engagement with the rest of the world run much more smoothly. It would help build productivity growth. It would take advantage of two cultural traits that I think are typically American, that we're very mobile as a country and we're very risk-taking as a country. But in many cases, you can see people holding back because they have a family member who's sick. They may have what you call a prior existing condition themselves, fearing that they won't be able to maintain health insurance. I think that fundamental structural change is something we need for the future, and it will have a significant over time effect on most of the economic problems we're wrestling with.
I'd like to echo that. I think that's very important. 95% of the world's customers lie outside the U.S. borders, and it is imperative that we not turn our back on that opportunity, but instead we pursue the opportunity that globalization gives us. Right now, I don't think the American public has any faith that its government is going to look out for it in the process of that pursuit. So we have to build.
I think they look at like the homelessness issue and some of the other issues that it doesn't seem that the government doing anything.
I think it's pretty straightforward what we've done. I mean, if you look at training programs, the unemployment insurance system was built on a 1950s model where basically, you know, business got bad, you went away for a while, they parked you, gave you a little bit of money, and waited for business to pick back up, you went back to the same job. That's not the way unemployment works now. When the job's gone, it's gone. And we have to build a system that recognizes that we're in a new world and gets people to a new job, gets them to a better job that's not going to disappear, builds some skills, and is not tied to trade. I think it's very, very, very imperative that we have just a displaced worker program. What we say now is, if you get dislocated by trade, oh my goodness, we'll do these things for you. I don't think they're very effective, but oh my goodness, we'll do this. If you just happen to lose your job, hey, have, you know, goodbye. That's crazy.
I was going to say that I'm not opposed to that, but I would just say that I don't think it's been an accident that the less educated workers have been hardest hit by trade. I think we've had conscious policy put less educated workers in direct competition with low-paid workers in the developing world. We could have designed our trade agreements to make it as easy as possible for smart kids from Mexico, India, wherever it might be, to come to the United States, work as our doctors, as our lawyers, as our economists, and directly compete with us. Now, I know there are economists born in India, so it's not an absolute barrier, but I can go to the store and get an avocado that was grown in Mexico. That doesn't mean we have free trade in the agriculture. So the point is, we've designed trade agreements that made it as easy as possible to set up the factory in Mexico, ship the goods back to the United States. We have not designed trade agreements that made it as easy as possible for those with the highest skills to compete with those with high skills in the United States. So it's been a very one-sided globalization. We've controlled the process. It's not just something that happened.
And we're talking about unemployment rate being historically low for non-teens. But we were talking about the construction. They just recently had 27,000 layoffs in the construction. Does there seem to be anything to that number? Is it accurate?
Well, there are definitely some problems in our data. I mean, I have to be careful here. No one's cooking the data, because I always raise this. I'm being an e-commerce nerd, but I'm not accusing anyone of cooking the data. But there's some issues here. It's hard to get data. What's going on in construction almost certainly is that we've had a lot of undocumented workers in construction. We know they're heavily employed in that sector, and they're probably not showing up in our jobs data. They're not showing up in the payroll data. So what that meant was when they started working in 03, 04, 05 during the construction boom, we didn't pick up the jobs that were being created there. Now that those jobs are disappearing, we're not picking up that decline in jobs. So that's part of the story that we're missing. So we've lost more jobs in construction than the data show. The other part, we do have relatively low unemployment, but one of the things that's been striking about this business cycle has been a large number of people dropping out of the workforce, something we really haven't seen before. Usually it's associated with a weak labor market. So if you look at the unemployment rate, it's hard to get too upset about a 4.7 unemployment rate. That's lower than it's been through most of the last 30, 35 years. So in the scheme of things, that's pretty good. But if we compare the employment rate, this is something Chairman Bernanke was pointing out a few years ago. If we look at the employment rate, the percentage of the population that's working, that's still about 2 percentage points below where it was back in 2000, the peak of the last cycle. So that is a big fall off. And, you know, to my mind, the best explanation, or maybe someone has another one, but the best explanation for that fall off is that it is a weak labor market. People don't see good opportunities out there. Otherwise, they would be working. I think you're very hard-pressed to explain why all these people who had been working a few years ago suddenly decided they'd rather do something else, whatever that might be.
We do know part of that. Part of the answer, not the whole 2%, is young people being in school instead of working. I think that's a good thing. We know that they need to be in school and get education and skills. The rest remains a mystery. I'm with Dean on that.
So you think it's the school? And you have
if you look at the numbers, it's clear that there was a big spike in teenage and young adult employment in the late 90s, early 2000. It came down, and they instead of going back in the labor force, that comparable age group is now in school. I don't think that's deeply mysterious.
No.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, it happened. I think the biggest thing to remember about the numbers that we're seeing is that the single numbers
mask a tremendous difference in what's going on in the economy. I mean, this is an economy that has places, Michigan, in absolute recession, California being hit by its housing market, Texas, Florida, same kind of thing, has some very strong states, not suffering. It has sectors of the economy, housing, absolute recession. You couldn't characterize a worse situation in housing, and very strong exports, very strong sectors. So it's an economy where I think people are nervous about the overall performance because you have to decide whether you believe the good news part, and there's a lot of good news still out there, or whether that's going to get dragged down by the bad news part. It's a very interesting time.
And that's with the, what he was saying about, is it going to be slow growth or recession?
Yeah. Well, I think that is the right question, and slow growth seems to be really a consensus outlook right now. And the question is, does it tip over into a recession? And it is partly related to housing, but partly related up to this uncertainty about the instruments that were created on the basis of subprime mortgages. So the Fed taking action, as one of your speakers suggested, of cutting a quarter percent or even 50 basis points, half of a percentage point, doesn't really get at this question of a large number of securities that can't be easily valued because they don't know what the subprime or some portion of which subprime is involved.
It could be another 18 months before all of this is going to be coming out in the wash.
I think that's probably true, and the question is, what can you do in the meantime to ease that process?
I have to put myself in the recession camp, basically based on housing. And, you know, we've seen incredible declines in the housing sector. So construction starts are down by more than 40% from their peaks a couple of years ago. But the more important part of the story is that that is going to hit consumption because you are seeing prices decline. And I think they're going to fall more rapidly. The basic story is we have an unprecedented oversupply of housing, and it's very hard to see in that story how you don't get more downward pressure on prices, particularly since that's coupled with the tightening up of credit, because all the people that made very foolish mortgage loans, you know, a year ago are now very reluctant,
well,
in
now,
some cases, to make even good
President
loans.
Bush just introduced this new policy the other day where it's there to rescue the homeowner. What do you think? Is that it going to have an effect on it?
I think it'll have a very limited effect. I mean, it's a mixed bag. It's a, you know, first off, it only affects subprime borrowers, which again, you know, these are the people who perhaps most need help. But it's just important to keep in mind that's a small fraction of those who are finding themselves in trouble keeping up with their mortgages. But secondly, it affects just a fraction of subprime borrowers, so it doesn't affect people whose interest rates have already reset. It doesn't affect people whose credit ratings have improved. I was arguing with someone the other day. They're saying, well, if their credit ratings have improved, they could just get, you know, a prime rate mortgage or go back and negotiate a lower rate. And that's not true if their house price has fallen, which has happened in many cases. They owe more in the value of their house. So, you know, all things equal, I'm probably glad he did that, but I think we're barely going to see it as more than a blip in terms of the rate of foreclosure, the rate of people losing their homes. I just don't think it affects it very much.
In the interest of spirited discussion, let me disagree with everybody to my right. First of all, I don't think it matters if it's a recession or not. I think that's an academics game. You always find out after the fact.
But
anyway,
is a policy set about where it's headed? I know that Bernanke was saying if it's inflation, we don't want to lower the rate. If it's a recession, we need to lower the rate. So really a lot of what they do is based upon whether it is heading for recession or inflation.
I think it's quite clear that we could have either growth of 0.2% or -0.2%, and it wouldn't change the policy call, and it wouldn't feel any different on the ground. So whether this thing hovers around zero, and we're at about zero right now, or it hovers a little below zero, I don't think changes A, how people feel, or B, the dynamics of the policy. The Fed will ease as much as it feels the inflation outlook allows it to, and that'll be that. So you can look at that. The second thing is, you know, yes, housing's way down, but housing was way up. And it's, again, not uniform. There are places where we didn't see this bubble. So the question will be, does it spill over into consumer spending enough to pull us down? Dean's forecast is yes. Evidence so far is no. And I think the last piece to remember is that the real vehicle by which we could get in big trouble is the fact that we had this, not just subprime mortgages, but a whole bunch of securities, which are these asset-backed securities. And there was either a mortgage behind them or a car loan or a credit card or you name it. And then you broke it up in little pieces and sold it around the globe. That product has been found to be defective, and there's a large-scale recall in place. And that's all that's going on. And how that will play out and the degree to which the subprime part, which we now know about, spreads over into the others is really, I think, going to be the key for whether we get a recession or not.
If I could throw in a, jump in a consumption point, though, you're right. We haven't seen a fall off in consumption. And the basic story here, at least in my book, is that there's a well-documented wealth effect. I don't know any economists who really dispute this, that somewhere between 4 and 6 cents of wealth in housing wealth translates in additional consumption each year. Now, by my calculations, we have roughly $8 trillion of housing bubble wealth, the additional wealth that was created as a result of house prices rising at more than their trend rate. So what that translates to is between $320 and $480 billion a year in additional consumption. Now, I'd say it's not entirely symmetric so that when house prices fall, you don't necessarily lose the consumption as quickly as when it goes up. People are reluctant to cut back their consumption habits. But inevitably, many people will have no choice because they've been borrowing against their homes. When they have zero equity in their home, they can no longer do that. And they're rapidly approaching that. If we look at a nationwide aggregate, the Fed just released numbers yesterday that show that the percentage of homes that people own, their equity to value ratio, it's just a hair over 50% now. If you go back 15 years, it was about two-thirds. So we've had an incredible fall in this equity to value ratio, even as house prices were going through the roof. So you would expect actually that the equity to value ratio would rise. You know, if my house price goes up 10%, I suddenly have 10% more equity. Right. You know, so as house prices went through the roof, we actually saw that ratio fall because people were borrowing at an incredible rate. Now you have a lot of people that are losing that ability to borrow simply because they have zero equity. So it's true. Doug's exactly right. We haven't seen the fall off in consumption. We've seen a rise in credit card debt. That's rising very rapidly now. People are doing whatever they can to sustain their levels of consumption. But they do hit a wall, and that's not going to be a pretty sight either for them as individuals or, do I think, for the economy as a whole.
Is that why you are now saying that this is a recession?
Whether we started one yet or not, you know, that I don't know. But I think we will see one before this crisis is resolved.
How serious a recession would you say?
My concern will be a very serious one because, you know, the classic recession, not a way to put it, but, you know, the recessions of the post-war period prior to the 2000 recession have all been induced by the Fed trying to fight inflation. They raise rates and they go a little too far. So what happens when you raise rates is people don't buy homes, they don't buy cars. But the nice part of that story is there's an easy recipe to get out of it. You lower rates, people haven't bought cars for a year or 2 years, they haven't bought a house for a year or 2 years, so there's huge pent-up demand. That's the kindling that gets the economy going. When you have a recession that's brought on by a housing crash, the problem isn't that people haven't bought homes for a year or 2 years. The problem isn't that people haven't bought cars. So I'm worried that it's not going to be easy to get the economy going again. And of course, that was exactly the problem that we had back in 2001, 2002. And that's why Greenspan pushed interest rates so low for so long, because it was very hard to get the economy back on its feet again. So I'm worried we'll be in that situation again, but we won't have another housing bubble to seize on to lift the economy.
Which was actually key in 2001. With the debt, which is something else that keeps coming up, where is, and not talking national debt, but into this consumerism that has been going on, into the fact that people are continuing to spend without having any equity to back it up. What is going to change that behavior? Is it hitting a wall? Is there something else that can be done that is going to help change? I keep, every time I think of this subject, I keep thinking of George Bush saying, you know, as American people go, what can we do to help? You know, this is a time of crisis. And he comes and he says, go shop.
Yeah.
And it seems like America's been shopping ever since.
They were shopping before. It requires very little to get Americans to shop.
That's true. In the 1980s, when people worried about Japanese competition, they would say that if there's a $1,000 tax cut, that Americans would spend the first $1,200 right away, and then the next $800 over time. And the Japanese, of course, would save the $1,200. I think there is something that we need to think about in terms of the international economy, because it really is an international imbalance that we really have been for several years the driver of the international economy by living beyond our means. And that means that if we suddenly reversed that pattern and started to increase the savings that Doug noticed was so low, you would really have something of a shock to countries that have become dependent on the U.S. market. So the best thing, I think, to do would be to have a meeting of the minds of the key countries that are on both sides of this imbalance, Europe, Japan, China, maybe Brazil and India, and work out something similar to what happened in 1985, where there was again an imbalance. The countries at that time agreed that the U.S. had too strong a dollar, too big a trade deficit, and over time we moved back to balance.
And if you do it over time, then the adjustments are much less severe. In this case, it would mean a shift by China to much more domestic consumption. It could actually be a blessing for them in that while they've done an incredible job in lifting 400, maybe 500 million people out of poverty, they still have a significant population that's lagged behind. They're sitting on, well, the last estimate I saw, something like $1.4 trillion of hard currency reserves. Those could be spent in part by building infrastructure in the interior of the country and so forth.
Do you think that that is something that China would be willing to do?
Well, I don't know, but I think it's something that a conversation that the international community really needs to stimulate, because you do not want to have a precipitous drop in the dollar. That would be bad for us. It would be bad for most of the trading nations of the world. And one thing that has happened is over time we no longer trade products as much. We trade parts, and it's a very complicated kind of trade. So this sudden breaking of a drop in demand and a drop in trade could be very disruptive for a lot of countries, and that wouldn't
including
be...
Including America.
Including America, absolutely.
Well, I very much agree with what Ken just said. I mean, I think we have to reorder, you know, our trading relations. I shouldn't say just ours, Europe's as well, with China. I mean, they have had this enormous trade surplus. And again, it's unusual for a developing country, because typically you expect a developing country to be borrowing, to be a borrower, you know, that they're building up their capital stock, building up their infrastructure. So China's been in this unusual situation. And again, it's hard to criticize.
Is that part of because they have such a large human capital?
Well, there wouldn't be on the face, you know, an explanation for it. I mean, I think it has been conscious policy on their part to really have this export-led growth, which, again, I'm reluctant to attack because, you know, as Ken's saying, they've had enormous success. They've lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. There's a lot of good things you could say about their development process to date. But it can't go on indefinitely, both for external and internal reasons. And in principle, they stand as much to gain as anyone by, you know, taking instead of, you know, basically handing us money for nothing, because that's in effect what they're doing now. They're buying up these reserves, and what are they getting for them? You know, very low interest, and the dollar's falling anyhow, so they're actually losing money on that deal. So instead of doing that, to redirect that money towards building up their infrastructure, building up, you know, meeting their domestic needs, they have horrible problems with pollution there. I mean, there's tons of things that you would think would be on their agenda that could improve their economy and the lives of their people very directly. So you would not think they would take that much arm twisting to go, you know, hey, don't you think you should be focused on generating domestic demand rather than focusing so much on exports?
Now, one of the other concerns that I hear often is that other countries are starting to now invest in euros, in other currency. What is that going to do to Americans?
Anytime you stop buying the dollar and buy something else, that lowers the demand for the dollar. It'll fall more than it would have otherwise. And so diversification of, you know, world portfolios into things like euros and other currencies is going to reduce the demand for the dollar. We'll see a lower dollar as a result. You know, Ken's concern is a precipitous decline. I think that's everyone's concern. If there's an orderly decline in the dollar, I don't see that as anything other than business as usual in market economies. I want to, you know, I'm a little less optimistic about the possibility of international agreements of the type that were laid out, in particular because China is going to do what China is interested in doing and has shown no interest in taking other advice. And so had they thought it was in their self-interest to clean up their environment, they'd have done it. You know, I'm sympathetic to the arithmetic of the argument, but the politics don't seem to be there. So I think the United States should think about what it needs to do. And certainly, if our households did not continue to be the last retail market on the planet, did not save so little, and instead chose to save some, we would see our businesses selling not just to U.S. households, but abroad. We'd see our households buying less in the way of imports from China, but importantly from Europe. And that would be a very important moment, because Europe would no longer be able to rely on selling to the U.S. They would then have a stake in this world.
The decline of the dollar, isn't that what this... Now you had,
the dollar is driving this. The dollar is driving this.
It hasn't happened yet with Europe.
Oh, it has happened with Europe. The Europeans are very upset.
But with the imports going...
We haven't seen an increase in their prices yet, but it's hard to believe that we will not see that. What I imagine is going on...
Will that lead us away from globalization then?
Well, it will reduce the amount we're importing from Europe, but I mean that, you know, it's not as though we're going to stop trade with Europe based on that. It simply means we'll import somewhat less. But what I suspect is going on is that you have a lot of European exporters. Obviously, the U.S. is an enormous market for them, and they're going to be very reluctant to raise their prices. And part of what they're thinking is, does this change in the currency? Is it permanent, in other words? So you don't want to raise your prices because, you know, the euro's up for, you know, a month or 2 months. You want to see that it's permanent.
You don't want to lose your customers.
Exactly. But on the other hand, you don't want to sell at a loss at the end of the day. So if the rise in the euro sticks, which my guess is it will, it might even go somewhat higher, that you will see higher prices for European goods, which will be passed on to some extent in the U.S. as higher inflation. That's in some sense unfortunate, but I just don't see any way around that. I mean,
what about the Chinese good? Are those also going to be going up?
This is what I think is the key, and I think the important development is the Europeans have now opened talks with China. The Europeans have sat on the sideline while the U.S. was put in the position of negotiating with China,
€2.
Good. Let's see Europe start pressuring China as well, and then get some responsible behavior in the world market. I think that would be a very good development and something we should look to see.
Yeah, so long and short, we will see. I think we're agreeing here that the dollar will fall against the Chinese currency, in part, based on the pressure of both the Europeans and the United States.
I think another element
is it going to affect the euro, though? If that happens.
Well, the euro will
equalize things.
The euro might actually fall somewhat against the dollar. You have this peculiar situation where, from the standpoint, if you're sitting there in Europe, you have this dollar block that it's the U.S. and China. So now if you...
And
the rest of Asia, that's right. So if you dislodge the U.S. from China, then you might get a situation where the dollar actually rises somewhat against the euro, but it will fall against the Chinese currency and the other Asian currencies.
Okay.
I think another element that was raised by one of your speakers is that you're going to see the Japan, China, other countries that have these enormous hard currency reserves shifting out of financial assets into more stable assets. You've seen a beginning in terms of China making modest investments in certain financial institutions, partly to diversify, but also partly as a learning. They want to see how the world financial business is really done. I would suggest that there'll be more movement now into buying land, buildings, other real assets that will protect them long term against the depreciation of their dollar assets. That in a sense, you could argue we are now finally going to be selling the North 40 for what has been a consumption binge.
Yeah, when you said about the going into stability, the euro, since it was launched, has actually been pretty stable, has it not?
Actually, it's gone through an enormous change. It went way down relative to the dollar, and now has gone way up. It's really, for several weeks, it was hitting a new record every week. The British pound is now over $2. And again, that's a record in terms of, I believe, the last 30 years. I mean, it's really been big changes, and they've taken the full brunt of this dollar decline. Canada, which not too long ago was selling at 75 cents on the U.S. dollar, and now they're quite proud to point out that the don't we wish we had more loonies, which are now worth slightly more than the dollar.
So I think actually there has been some jokes wondering when the peso is going to surpass the dollar, which has got to make people worry, right?
Doug earlier raised a very good point about how our system of health care based on employment had put an added competitive burden on many of our established industries.
And we're just about done. We have about 30 seconds apiece, or actually less, to 15 seconds.
Well, just let me finish by my last 2 seconds. We need to pay attention to our manufacturing and innovation base, which is going to drive prosperity long term and allow the U.S. to continue to play a leadership role abroad and build the American dream at home.
Dean.
Well, I would say the key things are we do have to get the currencies right. We have to get the dollar down. It will not be pretty, but we that's something we'll have to live with. And I think we're in for some real tough times with the housing crash.
I think the economy is going to struggle, may even dip below zero. But I don't think it's going to change the fundamental fact, which is our challenges are long term. they are in raising national saving, putting our fiscal house in order, and continuing to have the innovation that has been the source of our growth in the past.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming on American Dream.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
And that is Professor Kent Hughes with the Director Program on Science, Technology, U.S. and Global Economy, Dr. Douglas Holtz Aiken, Senior Fellow, Peterson Institute for International Economics, and Dean Baker, Co-Director, Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.